Please be seated. Before we begin our case this afternoon, you will notice that our bench is not full. Justice Rebecca Bradley, who normally sits in the chair down at this end of the bench, is participating and will be watching on Wisconsin Eye, but she is not able to be with us in the courtroom today. This morning, she did ask a question. I don't know whether that will be her mode this afternoon or not, but in any case, she is participating and will also be watching it on Wisconsin Eye. So, are you ready to proceed, counsel? Okay, please do.
May it please the court, my name is Attorney Anthony Cotton, and this is Attorney Tracy Wood, seated at counsel table. She handled the briefing, and I'm here handling the oral arguments, Your Honors. Thank you for hearing this important case. The integrity of the criminal justice system is preserved when defendants receive the effective assistance of counsel. This is a case where Anthony Pico was charged in Waukesha County with a child sexual assault, and he went to trial and ultimately was convicted of that count. Judge Boren presided over a two-day Mockner hearing in this case. At the Mockner hearing, the defense set forth considerable evidence about Mr. Pico's brain injury that he suffered in 1992. And make no mistake about it, this was
That is your most powerful argument, and that is what Judge Boren and then Judge Riley, dissenting at the Court of Appeals, spent an awful lot of time talking about is, gee, what does the brain injury mean for Mr. Pico vis-a-vis purported ineffective assistance of counsel? It seems to me that it was a little bit like the tail wagging the dog, and let me tell you why. The focus is not 2020 hindsight. What do examinations performed after the fact reveal? Rather, the focus is what would be apparent to an effective practitioner of the law. Now, Attorney Lavoie, the record shows that he handled, that's the phrase here, over or about 2,000 criminal cases. Now, I read through the transcript of the Mockner hearing and Attorney Lavoie's testimony. And while I know that Judge Boren conducted the Mockner hearing and he listened to testimony from the experts who studied Mr. Pico after the fact, after, 2020 hindsight after the fact. But when Mr. Lavoie is asked at the Mockner hearing, there are 20 occasions, at least 20, maybe more, depending on how you count. I counted groupings. I won't read through them all. But I've, as you can see with the tabs here, I've tabbed some of the ones that I thought were most telling, and I'll briefly summarize them. Question, so you were fully aware of the head injury? Answer, I was aware he was involved in a motorcycle accident. Did you have any records? I did not. Did you discuss with Anthony or his wife and family the deficits he had because of the brain injury? Answer, yes. We had a lot of discussion about his background and circumstances. There was never any indication of impulsivity that was ever noted in any of my conversations with Anthony nor his family. I think his family described him as kind of gregarious, funny kind of guy, a guy that was very likable and was funny, yes. Anthony indicated he had recovered and he was fine. Anthony told me he had gone to college and had maintained some jobs, some really good jobs after the accident. I'm going to skip over ones that might be repetitive. Ultimately, there was a lot of consideration. This is the attorney, Lavoie, that went into that. I had a number of meetings with Anthony leading up to the trial in which I would kind of call trial prep, where I worked with Anthony to provide potential testimony in the trial, and I came to the conclusion after I met with him and discussed his version of events multiple times that his version of events that he would testify to in court was very, very similar, almost identical, to what was in the recording with Detective Rich. So that goes to whether he should testify.
Right.
I didn't see any symptoms at all about any ongoing injury or deficit that he was having, so it didn't become an issue in my mind. He goes on in this similar vein, but the added part that I haven't addressed yet is how experienced the testimony brings out of Attorney Lavoie's ability to discern. Here he said, I would say in the several thousand, at least over 2,000 criminal cases that he has handled, and at least about 7 office consultations that he had with Mr. Pico. I anticipate there are probably more than that, but those are the ones I had noted in my file. I am experienced in discerning whether someone... I don't enter an NGI plea in a case unless I think there's a reason to do so. So he walks us through his analysis here. And then he, again, leads us to, and his family referenced how well-adjusted and how great he is. So it just didn't cause me to believe that it needed further explanation or exploration, so I did not pursue it. Okay, and there are more. So...
Thank you.
Rather than go through, you're welcome, rather than go through the whole litany of what the circuit court did here and what Judge Riley did, which is to look at this through the lens of 20/20 hindsight as if this was a de novo review, which it is not. We are to search the record for any deficient performance, and if we find any, we see if there is prejudice. What specifically was deficient about Attorney Lavoie's performance?
Thank you, Your Honor. And you're right that Attorney Lavoie testified that he did 2,000 or had handled 2,000 cases in his career, but quantity doesn't necessarily equate to quality.
Well, you've seized on exactly, I can go through all 20 if you want. You seized on one part of the testimony, but
you
heard what I just read, right?
I did, and I'm
sounds pretty thorough to me.
And I think what comes across in the transcript or what came across in the hearing that Judge Boren presided over was really a number of different things. But, you know, he's in the position where he can evaluate the
quality. I'm not asking about the hearing. I read that, too. I'm asking you, what is it about Attorney Lavoie's? I read this, and I thought to myself after I got done look, I was a prosecutor for 6 years before I went on the bench. I was the one trial court judge in my county for 6 years before I came here. I've served here for almost 10 years. I'm familiar with the concept of ineffective assistance of counsel. How we determine ineffective assistance of counsel is not when we have the benefit of perhaps a different version of events from what the trial counsel heard from family and friends and the defendant himself, and then a whole new hearing on what deficits he might have suffered from. We have to review it on what was known to the lawyer and what could reasonably have been known to the lawyer at the time.
Okay,
otherwise, we would be hearing every case at least twice. Now, you got away with it before. I want to focus, though, on the right analysis, which is what is it about Attorney Lavoie's conduct of this case that was deficient?
Thank you, and I'm attempting to answer Your Honor's question. Any practitioner in criminal defense who's presented with this type of case is going to know two things. The defense attorney is going to know that the care center interview will be played to the jury, and they're going to know that their client's interrogation, the surreptitious interrogation that was done in this case with the Reed method, the reasonable practitioner will know that
those
two pieces...
I've got to ask you to move the microphone closer and talk just a little bit slower. I'm not understanding you.
Okay. A criminal defense attorney, a reasonable criminal defense attorney presented with this fact pattern...
You don't think Attorney Lavoie was reasonable?
I don't think he performed reasonably in this case, no.
Okay, go ahead.
And a reasonable criminal defense attorney, a basic functioning criminal defense attorney presented with this fact pattern...
What fact pattern is it you're pointing to that Mr. Lavoie knew or should have known at the time?
A fact pattern, Your Honor, that has a compelling claim of innocence in it. A fact pattern that doesn't have any of the physical markers that we oftentimes see in criminal prosecutions. This is a report that was made by a child from a classroom setting.
The report was less than 1 second of under the clothing touching in the vaginal area, and you're saying that there should have been physical evidence of that?
I'm saying that there was significant reason. I'm saying that a reasonable attorney presented with that fact pattern, knowing that there was 1 second of touching that was alleged by the child, and knowing that there was not DNA evidence, there was not videotape evidence, there were not witnesses that saw that occur.
And you've just described 99.9% of every sexual assault that's reported across the country.
Okay. And when an attorney is presented with that fact pattern and then learns that their client was surreptitiously recorded by a detective with a secret recording device, that their client was lied to by the detective, was told that there's DNA evidence and there's not, was told that there's videotape evidence and there's not, was told that there's a child witness, which was a lie.
All of which is permitted under law, but go ahead.
The Reed method was implemented in this case. And what's unique about this case, Your Honor, is that Anthony Pico, just by visually looking at him, a person can see that there's a deficit. Now, the deficit is a profound deficit. And I'm not asking the court to implement 2020 hindsight.
When you say just by looking at him, I understand the record shows
right.
that he wears an eye patch, or at times relevant to this war, an eye patch. But what is it that should have been relevant to attorney, which that should have been apparent to Attorney Lavoie, just by, to use your phrase, just by looking at him?
Right. Well, he asked the question. So Attorney Lavoie really did nothing, Your Honor, other than just ask the question of Mr. Pico whether he made a recovery or not.
Wait a minute. What about his questions of the family? What about his questions of the family's representation? He's a great guy. He's very well adjusted. What about the comments from Mr. Pico talking about graduating from college and having good jobs?
Sure.
What about the complete absence of over 7 trial preparation meetings where Mr. Lavoie observed no cognitive deficit?
The problem is that the sources that Mr. Lavoie was almost exclusively relying on his interactions with Anthony Pico. The family didn't have a long history with Anthony Pico before this injury took place. This was something that happened in 1992, and he was medically discharged from the military as a result of it. So this was a profound injury that took place. And what I would submit to Your Honor is that oftentimes asking an individual, as a criminal defense attorney, asking your client, asking the brain-damaged person, the person who has suffered the brain injury, asking that person, how are you, and asking, you know, what do you do, doesn't get at the root cause of how severe the injury was. And oftentimes, the brain-damaged person isn't the best historian of what the extent of their injuries were. This was a profound injury.
Counsel, are you proposing that part of the deficiency was that the failure to get the medical records precluded the consideration of an NGI defense?
And that's what Judge Boren had noted, that the Felton case controls on that, and that is part of our claim, Your Honor.
Okay. So, Did Judge Boren make any credibility determinations at the Mockner hearing?
Specifically, did he make credibility determinations?
Yes.
I think he certainly found that the testimony, I mean, I think he certainly found the testimony persuasive of Drs. Yealy and Dr. Capote, for example.
Did he make any adverse findings about the credibility of Mr. Lavoie?
I think implicit within his ruling is that he's finding that Attorney Lavoie he's factually finding that Attorney Lavoie didn't do an adequate investigation in this case. He didn't use the magic word that Your Honor is suggesting.
Right. So, and part of the reason I ask that is because of some of the specific things that were in evidence in the Mockner hearing. For example, the state says, perhaps you'll tell me if the state is wrong in this, the state, pages 16 and 17 of its brief, said, Pico expressly told Lavoie that he knew touching DT's vagina was wrong, and that touching her leg made her uncomfortable. Pico's wife, Michelle, stated that there was no question Pico understood that it was wrong to touch a child's vagina. Is the state correct in that statement?
Those statements were made to Attorney Lavoie?
Those statements were made to Attorney Lavoie
by
Pico
and by his family. That's in the record, Your Honor.
All right. So part of the NGI defense is an assertion that he was unable to distinguish right from wrong in ordering his affairs, correct?
Or failure to conform his conduct. There's two prongs.
Well, everyone who's convicted of a crime fails to conform their conduct to the law.
But there's two prongs to the NGI defense. One, of course, is what Your Honor says, that the person fails to appreciate the wrongfulness.
Yeah.
The other prong would be the person who fails to have the ability to conform.
But it's more an inability.
Unable.
And a failure. The failure
inability
results
to conform.
From an inability.
Right.
That's a more accurate.
Right. So in this case, both Mr. Pico and his wife said that he knew that doing this would be wrong, right?
Right.
Okay. So let's stop there for a moment. Is there anything in the Mockner hearing that suggests that Judge Boren did not believe Mr. Lavoie or did not believe those statements?
No, I don't think he disbelieved that aspect of the testimony.
Okay. So, for now, just with respect to the potential NGI defense, if that evidence is in the Mockner hearing, what basis would you have for an NGI defense?
Well, it's the fact that it could be explored. Remember that the record is clear that there was testimony from Dr. Capote in this case who talked about the pervasiveness of the brain injury.
Yeah. So let's say that we, having the benefit of hindsight, that we said, okay, you know, we're going to turn over all the stones and we're going to engage in this review of the medical history to determine if something might be there, right? But that, as Justice Gableman indicated, that's not our review. Our review is, was there something presented to Mr. Lavoie that should have suggested to him that he needed to get that medical record so he could explore that, right?
Yes.
So having been told both by Mr. Pico himself and by Mr. Pico's wife that he understood the wrongness of the thing with which he was charged, what is it that is supposed to suggest in Mr. Lavoie that he needs to get that medical history?
Well, I think based on that alone, there wouldn't necessarily be anything. Based on that statement, there wouldn't be anything that would suggest an NGI based on that.
So what else do you got?
Well, what we have, Your Honor, is that Mr. Lavoie was made aware of the fact that Mr. Pico suffered the serious injury that he did.
Yes, an injury, and it's a serious injury. It causes him to need to wear an eye patch. Right?
I want to clarify something because I don't want Justice Kelly or any other member of the bench to be under a misapprehension. What Mr. Lavoie was made aware of was that at some point Mr. Pico was in a motorcycle accident, right?
And he testified that he was aware that it was a head. He fought the defense on that question. He was aware it was a head injury also, Your Honor, that it was a motorcycle accident with a companion head injury, which resulted in
the
loss of an eye or the
use of the phrase, this injury has a certain connotation. So there was a motorcycle accident with a head injury,
which resulted, as the records reflect, resulted in Mr. Pico being hospitalized in a medically induced coma for 5 days.
So
Your Honor, let me
just see if I can finish up my question here then. So Mr. Lavoie is told by Mr. Pico and his wife that he knew that what he's accused of doing is wrong, right? And all Mr. Lavoie knew at that time is that there was a head injury that caused Mr. Pico to wear an eye patch. What else is there to suggest that he should have gone and sought the medical records to explore this more in depth?
Because a defense attorney defending a child touching case has to give some explanation to the jury as to why their client is touching the child's leg in the classroom.
Yes, and in this case,
there was no
Mr. Lavoie decided to pursue a defense that it did not occur.
It's unclear what Attorney Lavoie's defense was, to be honest, Your Honor.
It was that the touching did not occur.
Except he didn't do anything to advance that defense.
It didn't occur.
He didn't present a single witness to advance that defense. He didn't examine any medical records to advance that defense. When Attorney Lavoie was presented...
Hang on just a second. I know you're appellate counsel.
I
know you're appellate counsel. But generally speaking, in a trial, one gets acquainted pretty quickly with the idea that you can't bring witnesses to things that didn't happen. Right?
Right.
Okay. So if the defense is, this did not happen... What evidence do you expect Mr. Lavoie to have presented that it did not happen?
Well, what I expect from it, what I think this court ought to demand as a basic level of performance for a defense attorney is some effort to advance a client's claim at the trial court level. One of the pieces of information that Attorney Lavoie was presented with, Your Honor, was that the Pico daughter had a sensory processing disorder, and that Mr. Pico and the family had been trained by doctors and medical professionals to rub her leg during the time that they would read to her.
But this is a different part of your case.
But that's Your Honor.
But what I'm looking for, your case is primarily based on this idea that he should have sought out the medical records.
Right.
And given that he and his wife both disclaimed a basis for an NGI plea, what I'm trying to figure out is what should have suggested to Mr. Lavoie that he should disregard what Mr. Pico said and what his wife said and conclude, you know what, I think there might be something there notwithstanding their denial.
Sure.
And therefore, I must go find the medical records. What is there of such a nature that would cause him to come to that conclusion?
I think when Attorney Lavoie testified about his interactions with the Pico family, one of the things he testified to was prepping Mr. Pico for his testimony. And he described Mr. Pico as somebody who was flustered, becoming easily frustrated, somebody that he was having trouble communicating with and presenting a coherent he didn't think he was going to be able to present a coherent narrative to the court with Mr. Pico. That should signal to an attorney that there's something wrong, Your Honor.
Besides, there's an alternate explanation for getting easily flustered when questioned about this kind of activity, isn't there?
There could be a number of explanations, but in this case, there was also the eye patch and the corresponding brain injury that he suffered.
Mr. Lavoie testified that Mr. Pico's defense had pretty much been made through the recording with the law enforcement officer. That's why he decided not to put Mr. Pico on the stand, that he was getting everything through the recording that he would have had Pico say on the stand if he had testified. That was, you can shake your head, but that's, I'll find the part in the transcript.
I agree with you that he testified to that. I disagree that that's reasonable. I disagree that that's reasonable for a trial attorney. If you look at this interrogation, and it's part of the record, this is not any, and Judge Boren properly found this, Your Honor, this is not some sort of full-throated denial where Mr. Pico is denying that these things took place. You can see that Mr. Pico is being led down a path by Detective Rich during this secret recording that he was doing. And it is, and Judge Boren made this finding, and I think it should be respected by this court, that was not a reasonable strategy because that interrogation that took place was not the type of firm denial that we would...
What's to say that he wouldn't be led down an even worse path by a prosecutor in the context of a jury trial?
Right, and of course that's part of the analysis.
Mr. Lavoie, who's done 30 to his testimony was how many jury trials and probably court trials defending people. He said in the 20 to 30 range, and then he went on to say, and this is the context in which he's making this decision. It's not like he's a recent law school graduate who's just done appellate work and never been in the trenches before. He says, the question is, do you remember how often you met with Mr. Pico, let's say prior to jury trial? I look back at my notes, and I think I had about 7 office consultations that I noted in my file. It was at least 7, probably more. That's not the part I wanted to read. Here it is. And I specifically, with respect to Mr. Pico, rather than in general, question, you considered the NGI but ultimately decided it wasn't appropriate for Mr. Pico, correct? Answer, that's correct. Can you summarize, I guess, why you believed it was inappropriate in this case? Answer, in Mr. Pico's situation, he was able to tell me very specifically his version of events from start to finish. It was logical to me. He was able to communicate with me effectively. He didn't have any indication he was not understanding the difference between right and wrong. He clearly knew it was wrong to touch the vaginal area of a child. He knew that he made her feel uncomfortable by touching her leg. So I sensed initially that he clearly knew the difference between right and wrong. There was no question in my mind. I didn't see anything in my interview with him or my collateral discussions with his family that caused me to believe he was in any way impulsive or was not able to control his behavior. Other times he wasn't able to control himself or do certain things. He adamantly denied that.
I think what I appreciate the cite to the record, and I think what Judge Bourne was really troubled by in this case, though, is that it's the constellation of errors that we're dealing with here. And I understand the focus on just an NGI dimension of the case, and that in Felton is good law that an attorney cannot abandon an NGI defense without any level of consultation. We know that there's an expert in this case who would have testified that
before you get to expert testimony, the lawyer must form a reasonable basis, a reasonable belief that there's a purpose to bring in the experts.
Right.
And from this transcript, the reason I'm going through this exercise with you, the reason I put myself through this exercise of reading all of this, is to ask myself, well, what did he see, what was brought out at the Mochner hearing that should have cued him in to the notion that further investigation of the long-term effect of the 92 accident requires expert testimony, which so swayed Judge Bourne and then Judge Riley at the Court of Appeals. So before we jump to this so-called, as you say, constellation of errors, let's focus on whatever purported deficient performance that might have been there. I'm not seeing it, and I'm asking for your assistance to help me see it.
Okay, and I'm attempting to answer Your Honor's questions. I think the I see that my time is up. Can I answer Justice Gableman's
question? Yes, please answer his question.
I think there's reason to be concerned about the integrity of the conviction in this case, Your Honor. Mr. Pico went to trial without the benefit of any of this important evidence coming in front of the jury. Without the benefit of any of this important evidence coming in front of the jury. Evidence which, if presented, would have explained why Mr. Pico was rubbing a child's leg in a classroom. Evidence that would have challenged the care center interview that was done in this case. Evidence that would have given the jury some context to the interrogation so that the jury would have understood why Mr. Pico was being led down a path that a lot of other people may have just shut down the interrogation right away. But Mr. Pico, because of his unique susceptibility, was not able to do that. And I think what would signal to most trial attorneys when we're in the trenches defending cases, and we have somebody who tells us that they've suffered a brain injury, the easiest thing we can do as a practitioner, Your Honor, is have that client sign a release and send off of those records. It doesn't require a Shifra analysis. It doesn't require going in front of a judge. It is the easiest base-level thing that a trial attorney can do. And I would submit that whenever a mens rea is a component of a crime and you learn that a client has a major brain injury, something that's still to this day causing outward signs of deficits, you have an obligation to go further and at least get those records and consult with somebody about that. And I think also Attorney Fink testified to that,
Your
Honor.
You're saying things that I don't think are in the transcript, but out of respect for the red light, I'm not going to ask.
Thank you. The State, please prepare.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Sarah Burgundy, and I represent the State of Wisconsin. Anthony Pico received more than competent representation in his trial for child sexual assault in this case.
And Ms. Burgundy, you are not so encumbered by a red light, so I will ask you.
Okay.
Where, if you know, in the transcript of the Mochner hearing, was Attorney LaVoy informed in any detail besides that Mr. Pico had been in a motorcycle accident in 1992, from which he had, according to Mr. Pico and his family, fully recovered, except for the residual use of an eye patch? Where was Mr. LaVoy, if you can tell me, informed that he had suffered a brain injury whose effects he was still feeling?
That was not in the transcript for the Mochner hearing. He was told there was a brain injury, but Mr. Pico reported that he had recovered and was fine, and then in subsequent conversations with the family, no one ever raised concerns that he had been suffering ongoing injuries, ongoing symptoms or effects from the injury.
I'm concerned by my read of the transcript, and particularly I'm talking about the McNair hearing transcript, of course, and particularly what the judge gave as his rationale, because that's what we are in part examining here.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge focused in part, I think, certainly not on the NGI. The judge didn't say, oh, there was enough there in the NGI. Rather, the judge said that the mental health condition, I'll use the phrase permeating. I don't know if that's actually the word he used, but that it encompassed much of the trial strategy and investigation. I want to be specific. My concern is this. The judge at page 61 of the appendix. In the
May I grab my...
Sure, please do. At the very bottom of page 60 and the top of page 61, the judge said that, look, in listening to the recording, there were several inculpatory statements made by the defendant, Mr. Pico, and, quote, at best for the defense were equivocal, not outright denials, and not as solid as denials of someone simply stating, I didn't do it. The judge said that essentially at the same thing at Appendix 64 when he said, look, these were equivocal denials. And when I read that and when I looked at the transcript, I was in accord with the judge. Let me tell you what concerns me here, and then get your response to it. What concerns me is the strategy was beyond a reasonable doubt strategy. And a beyond a reasonable doubt strategy may be the appropriate strategy in a he said, she said case of sexual contact and assault, when there's one side saying, I did it, you did it, the other side saying, no, I didn't do it. But a read of the transcript, my read, consistent with Judge Barron's read, as indicated in those pages, is that what you have is the officer, or the detective, saying, she's claiming that you put your hand on her vagina. Is that right? And essentially over and over again, the defendant said things like, I don't know. I don't remember. The officer said, well, is it possible? The defendant, yes, it's possible, but I don't remember. And then he went on to say, I didn't touch her vagina. But then right after that, when asked the same question, he says, I don't know, I don't remember. So to me, it is not a reasonable defense to say there is a reasonable doubt strategy when you have one side saying he did it and the other side saying, I don't know, it's possible, I don't remember, I didn't do it, but I don't know, I don't remember. Not everyone is Perry Mason. And when you go into trial with one side saying he did it and the other side saying, I don't know, it's possible, I don't remember, I didn't do it, I don't remember, you need more than that. It's unreasonable to go in with that, it seems to me. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. With a read through the transcript of the interview, Mr. Pico consistently said that I did not touch her vagina. Now, there are a number of points where the officer said, well, you know, he acknowledged that he was tickling her up and down the leg. He said, you know, my hand may have gone a little bit under her pants when the officer asked, well, is it possible? He said either, I don't know. The key is here that Attorney Lavoie acknowledged at the Mockner hearing that this was not a perfect interview. It was not an interview in which Pico simply said, not only did I not touch her, I didn't touch her leg, I didn't touch her vagina, I wasn't even near her, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't a, he acknowledged this wasn't a denial, just flat out, that nothing.
That's right. And maybe your read of it is a little different than my read. I mean, I've got this all queued up, but I won't go through it right now. But you can see the tabs I'm holding up where he's going over, I don't know, I don't remember, it's possible, I don't think so. Now, I certainly realize that he also denied it, but he denied it sometimes in conjunction with, I don't know, I don't recall ever doing it, you know, and then saying, well, I know, then he follows that with, I know I didn't touch her vagina. You know, so it's
sure.
It's all jumbled.
Sure.
So the question is, now my read of it actually is consistent with Judge Barron's read of it, which maybe is inconsistent with yours. But what's our standard of review in terms of listening to the testimony at the Mockner hearing and Judge Barron's comments several times that this mental health condition that was testified to appears to have permeated or has the potential of permeating the strategy and the investigation that was done? So what's our standard review? You may disagree with me, but I say with due respect, you know, okay, people disagree with me, but that's not the issue. The issue is what Judge Barron's decided and whether or not that was reasonable when he found ineffective assistance of counsel.
To the extent Judge Barron is making factual findings, those are under the clearly erroneous standard. To the extent he is applying those findings to the question of deficiency or prejudice,
that's
de novo.
Boilerplate, right?
I mean, it is boilerplate.
Okay, but give me the.
I also want to note. To the extent Judge Boren made findings relative to the trial, relative to the trial, which he didn't sit on, by the way, it was Judge Domina.
Yes.
We have case law saying that those are entitled to de novo review. So and that will fit into kind of the Strickland analysis, but in more direct response to your comment that, you know, there are problems here with this interview, I think the keystone here is two things, that the read technique, or the criticism of the read technique, is that it produces false confessions,
mm-hmm.
tendency to produce false confessions. We have neither anything false here. Attorney Lavoie testified that Mr. Pico told me what happened. It was nearly identical to what he told Attorney Rich. He never claimed that he made a false statement to Attorney Rich. He also never confessed. He maybe made, like Judge Boren said, equivocal statements. He made some things that sounded, that were perhaps difficult for the defense, but he never confessed to the crime. So neither of those components were produced by this interview. And Attorney Lavoie had made a reasonable decision to say, hey, I have my client. He makes a few difficult comments here, but he stuck to his guns. He was being questioned. He brought out to the jury that...
Counsel, tell me just, if you can, why a beyond a reasonable doubt strategy was reasonable given Judge Barron's view of the evidence.
Isn't it Judge Boren? You keep saying
I meant Boren, Mike Boren, yes, I'm sorry.
If I understand your question, why was a reasonable doubt strategy reasonable given Judge Boren's view of the evidence? So when you're talking about the evidence, specifically the Rich interview, or are you talking about all the evidence that came in?
All the evidence that came in.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes back to some of the concerns that Justices Gableman and Kelly raised in my opponent's argument, was that we're not looking at this 2020 hindsight. We're not looking at all of the possible things that counsel could have found later where he had no reason to believe that any of these experts were necessary in the case.
Well, he didn't come up with anything other than there was no witnesses called, nothing. The only thing he had was this, I think, inculpatory, and as Judge Barron's viewed the evidence, Mike Bourne, as he viewed the evidence, at best equivocal. Inculpatory, at best, for the defense, equivocal. How can you rely on that?
Well, I'll also add, Mr. Pico is not offering an alternative. So I think, as I noted in my brief, when you're presenting a reasonable doubt defense, in this case, he could have presented just the Reed interview. He could have presented Mr. Pico's testimony. He could have presented both. But he evaluated what Mr. Pico's testimony would look like. It would look the exact same as the Rich interview. I keep changing the names. It would look the exact same as the Rich interview, but it would also have the disadvantage of subjecting him to a cross-examination that, in his professional judgment, he did not believe Mr. Pico would do well.
And Ms. Burgundy, when I consider Justice Ann Bradley's questions, my first thought comes to mind is, how does it get better at trial? Be that as it may, one point that has not been brought up is the fact that early on in his interrogation by the detective, Mr. Pico was advised, as your opposing counsel mentioned earlier, as sort of an implicit indictment of the police interview, which is that the police lied to Mr. Pico. And one of the ways they lied to him is they said, we have you on videotape doing this.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So under those circumstances, it almost seems to make sense that a defendant will give equivocal responses thinking, I don't think they have me on videotape, but in case they do, my memory might not be there, but if that videotape shows I did, I just don't recall it. So it seems to me that this is not some big mystery as to why he's going to respond, I don't recall, especially if he's advised that the police have videotape of him touching the child's vagina.
Sure.
He's going to respond, well, I don't recall, but I deny it, but I'm still going to equivocate. Just in case you have that videotape, I don't remember.
Sure.
And that, coupled with the fact that that kind of statement, once introduced at trial, I don't know what kind of oratory or magic explanation for it is going to convince a jury that anything the person has to say on the witness stand is going to make it better for the defense case.
I think that's right, Your Honor, and I want to point to some of Attorney LaVoy's testimony, too, is that he listened to the interview and he noted that Mr. Pico made some of these more equivocal statements and said, I think even without the comments in the beginning about the video, that, you know, people generally tend to want to agree with police, or they, you know, that his responses were not really much different from what he had seen defendants in his other cases, how they respond to police, how they respond to the pressure. They generally want to be, you know, you don't want to be, you know, pressing back. And so, you know, in his view, this really wasn't something that warranted getting an expert or getting, you know, raising additional challenges to.
Was there anything that should have been known by trial counsel that would have caused him to believe that Mr. Pico was unable to conform his conduct to what the law required?
I think at one point in the Mochner testimony, Attorney LaVoy says, listen, if I had gotten anything from the family about, you know, he's engaged in impulsive behavior before, anything about, you know, he tends to act in this way, or, you know, we're not surprised he touched the girl's leg and didn't, you know, just anything. I mean, Attorney LaVoy was pretty clear. I, you know, had I been given anything, I would have sought an expert, I would have sought the medical records.
Well, the NGI defense, of course, is the opposite of what's maintained. It's essentially, I did it, but I couldn't help it.
Correct.
Okay. And so my concern was, is there anything that his trial counsel should have noted that might have caused trial counsel to disbelieve his claim of innocence, but to believe that he couldn't control his conduct?
Nothing that Attorney Lavoie testified to, and nothing that really anybody else at trial testified to. Mr. Pico's wife, Michelle, testified, and none of her testimony suggested that they told him anything or provided any additional information to him that he could act on.
Thank you.
The court asked in the order, and I hope I have the right case, the court asked in the order whether the calling of another attorney to explain what the standard is for attorneys is appropriate. Would you address that?
Sure. And let me be clear. I think what we're asking the court to do is simply reaffirm what the Court of Appeals said in McDowell, and that is that Strickland experts are improper in Mockner hearings. And so I want to be clear about what I mean by a Strickland expert, is that it's in the context of a Mockner hearing, a criminal defense attorney who is not involved in the challenge representation, but who is held out as an expert on whether challenge counsel provided competent representation. This is essentially what the Court of Appeals said in McDowell, and this is how the Mr. Pico offered Attorney Finke's testimony in the, and I think Finke, in the Mockner hearing.
Fink.
Is it Fink? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Borens.
It's Borens.
That'd be the judge.
O.S. Borens.
And so it's basically, you know, to just, and at the risk of summarizing my brief, it's not relevant. It's the court's job to determine deficient performance and prejudice.
Counsel, what happens if perhaps the trial judge, that's, I don't think the case here, but just hypothetically, what if the trial judge was not aware of the different resources available to defense counsel to develop different theories of defense? Would it be appropriate to have a witness to come in to testify about that?
I think that falls outside what I'm defining as a Strickland expert. So as long as if you need an expert to come in to say, just, okay, how does defense counsel just even function? What's, you know, I think the court would need to make a finding, a specific finding of why this would be helpful, why it's necessary. But to the extent that you're calling an expert to say, I reviewed this counsel's performance and I would do something differently, or I believe he performed deficiently or made a mistake on this particular point, that's really outside the realm.
Yeah. Now, I think Mr. Cotton would say that Mr. Finke was called to give entirely factual testimony, and that he was not giving his opinion on the ultimate question, which is whether there was deficient performance or not. What do you think of that? What parts of his testimony would you point to and say, that's really testifying about whether there was deficient performance?
Oh, I think all of it was. I mean, to the extent he said, Attorney Lavoie did this, and here's where I would do it differently, that's getting into the realm. I think to call it, to say he's testifying to factual testimony, it makes him not an expert. I mean, and he doesn't have first-person factual knowledge of what happened in this case. So that falls by the wayside. And I think to the extent they're saying, well, he was just testifying to general standards, that's not borne out in the record. Before the Mockner hearing, counsel asked that Attorney Finke be present in the courtroom and said, I want him to hear Attorney Lavoie's testimony because I'm going to ask him questions about, I'm assuming Attorney Lavoie is going to talk about his decision, and I want to be able to him to be able to respond to Attorney Lavoie's decisions in this case. So it was really, he was there basically to say, I think this was right and that was wrong, and go to the ultimate legal question, which is the court's job.
I'm concerned, and I looked at the non-party brief that was filed here. One of the words or phrases that stuck in my mind was generally is not always. And the position was generally you wouldn't have an expert witness, but that doesn't mean they should be precluded. Of course, expert testimony, you don't need to have personal information. The standard is whether or not we'll assist the trier of fact. Mm-hmm. And I can think of situations where you have, for instance, a new trial judge is not at all knowledgeable about criminal law in terms of the background and experience of that new trial judge, faced with very, very important decisions.
Sure.
And I can see a new trial judge being assisted by expert testimony of a criminal defense lawyer that sets forth what are the kind of parameters, what's the reasonable, the standard of conduct, what's reasonable or available to do in these circumstances. How are young trial judges to know this? This is not part of their universe. They don't know this information until they're told it.
Well, our case law in Strickland holds that all of this information is in Strickland. It's in the cases interpreting and applying Strickland. We use the ABA standards as guidance. We use the Supreme Court rules conduct for guidance. But I think, again, to the portion of your question that's what about the just inexperienced judge that doesn't understand.
This is the trier of fact. I think most judges, certainly most experienced judges, don't want an expert in this area. But some may, so why should we preclude it?
I think to the part of your question where you're saying, well, how does a judge know what's reasonable? Again, that's the job of the judge of what's reasonable. I think to the extent a judge might need an expert to say, here's what typically happens in an initial meeting with a client. Here's what typically happens in trial prep. Here's what typically happens. But again, the question of whether challenge counsel in this particular case, under the universe of facts and knowledge that counsel had and the decisions he makes, that's all goes to the judge. I mean, that all goes to the trier of fact. That's his or her role, to determine whether counsel was deficient and whether counsel was prejudicial.
Let me push that just a
sure.
bit, if I may. And of course, now I'm borrowing on civil law, but what's wrong for a new judge to hear about what's the standard in the industry? What's the standard of care, so to speak, by borrowing from the civil context, not making necessarily a decision or an opinion on whether or not there was a breach, borrowing from the civil law of that standard, not necessarily saying in the criminal context the defense attorney was deficient in performance because he didn't meet the standard of care, not saying that, but at least letting the new trial judge know what the standard of care is or what the norm is or what's reasonable to be expected. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think we're kind of crossing two concepts. So the courts, the appellate courts addressing Strickland have been careful to not use the term standard of care to describe what we're looking at as reasonable performance. Again, it's a totality of circumstances question. The reason that we have experts in the malpractice scenario, and the reason they're often required, is because it's going to a jury who's not an expert on law, is not an expert on what lawyers do. And it goes to the question of whether counsel was negligent and not meeting a standard of care, not the question of everything that counsel knew. I think the other difference between the two is that under Strickland, the court is to apply very heavy deference to counsel's decisions and reasonableness versus in malpractice situations, there's not that overlying deference. So hope I'm answering your question, but I think the standard of care question needs to stay in the civil context.
Yeah,
and I think what I'm trying to argue is that bringing an attorney that was not involved in the case to testify on the ultimate legal decision that the judge is tasked to make can never be relevant, can never be appropriate.
Can it be, if I may just a second, can it be relevant if an attorney offers reasonable options or what would be considered reasonable options. Again, you know, an expert witness doesn't have to have personal knowledge of anything. They can almost stand up and give a lecture, you know, under the rules of evidence. That doesn't happen very often. But
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I do want to point out, too, in this case, Judge Warren is a very experienced judge and had experience with defense.
Yes,
so, and he didn't make any findings saying, this is, you know, I would like this person to testify, and here's why.
Let me pass the baton.
Yeah, well, to me, it sounds a little bit like, with all due respect, you want the expert to be the judge's law clerk. The judge has got to investigate the law. Judges all the time meet legal questions, and they don't know the answer, and you got to get the books out, see what's happened in the past, and apply the law that's required to the facts of the case.
Exactly. And I think, you know, this case bears out the kind of risk of that sort of expert testifying. I think his, you know, to the extent his findings, Attorney Finke's testimony got mixed into the findings, I think demonstrates how it could kind of actually step into the judge's role in that case.
Well, but if the lawyer files a brief, the lawyer is going to say what is the law and what a reasonable lawyer would do under these circumstances. So you can do it in a brief, but you can't testify. Is that the point?
Well, I think, in that case, it's, you know, I think there's also two other experts in the courtroom along with the judge, and that's the prosecutor and the
sure.
defense attorney. So they're, you know, when they're questioning challenge counsel, they're bringing out the questions. Are you aware of this case? What did you do here? What did you know at this point when you made this decision? And that's kind of what's building the basis for the court to make this decision, not this sort of generalized, I'm going to bring an attorney in to say what he or she would have done under the circumstances. That's just, it has no value in terms of what the court needs to decide.
The general rule is that if the judge thinks that he or she needs expert testimony, that's when you bring it in, right?
It's
I think Gilbert might require.
There's a little more to it. I think if they need to make a finding that it's relevant, that it's helpful,
sure.
But not
okay.
Right. You know,
but you're
I think
not
under,
arguing this was irrelevant.
It is irrelevant.
Yes.
It is relevant.
That the attorney thinks testimony under the circumstances was irrelevant.
Irrelevant is what you said.
Not relevant, yes.
Why? Why?
The echo.
We used to agree. What happened? I don't know.
Why?
It was irrelevant because what Attorney Finke would have done under the same circumstances is, it doesn't matter. I mean, the state,
well,
I mean,
see,
they could have brought in 10 attorneys saying, I would have done something different, and it would have had the same result. I think it, you know, kind of goes back to the, you know, the idea Learned Hand talked about, the theory of contracts. If you bring 20 bishops in to say the words mean a certain thing, it doesn't matter. Whatever counsel did and knew at the time and how that affected his decision-making is what the question is, and that's a question for the trier of fact, not for a whole gallery of experts to come in and say either way. So I just wanted to add an additional point. I think, you know, kind of the gestalt of the other side's case on deficiency is that under the circumstances, counsel had to essentially retain experts on the care center interview, on the Reed interview, on the medical issues from the get-go. And I mean, our position is that he just had no reason to believe that. And there, I think to the extent this court wants to avoid using this case to make a general rule that from the get-go, counsel needs to just get experts regardless of what he knows or what he has available to him or what he's reasonably investigated, I think is it goes against kind of what this court has already held in terms of eyewitness experts and other types of forensic experts being brought into trial. I wanted to respond to a point. They noted that the family didn't have a long history with Mr. Pico. My understanding was that he and his wife got married in 97, which was 2 years after the accident. So if Mr. Pico was demonstrating signs or deficits or had issues from the accident, they would be in the position to know it and have observed it and experienced it. Justice Kelly, you had asked about credibility findings. There were no explicit credibility findings, but in my reading of the Mochner hearing, there really wasn't competing evidence on any point. And when I read Judge Boren's findings, he's essentially just saying, I heard this person say this, I heard this person this. And in effect, he's saying, I believe everybody, but I think that counsel was deficient and whatever. So unless there's other questions, I'm asking this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Cotton, the state has made a distinction between Mr. Fink's testimony to the extent that it refers to how he would have handled the case as opposed to how defense counsel actually did versus the traditional fact questions of who, what, and when, where, right?
Right.
Do you agree with that distinction?
I think in part, the government cited the McDowell case, or maybe one of your honors cited the McDowell case, where there's a footnote that talks about the use of these types of witnesses. And we're not suggesting that this court create a broad principle that the trial courts are required to allow this type of testimony. It's
right. Just the question of whether it is allowable. But why, if that's a valid distinction that the state makes, why should there be a witness testifying about how he would have handled the defense differently?
Well, that mischaracterizes the testimony, Your Honor. What the defense, what Mr. Pico sought to do in this case was call a defense attorney, to call Mr. Fink to offer testimony about what a reasonable attorney would do under those circumstances.
Right. And the point of the testimony about what a reasonable attorney would do was to distinguish that from what defense counsel actually did, correct?
Well, he wasn't being called to offer an ultimate conclusion on the performance. He was being called to educate the trial court on the types of things that a reasonable defense attorney would do in a child sex assault case such as this one.
How does that differ from the first prong of Strickland?
How does it differ?
Yes.
I don't think the lawyer, Mr. Fink, isn't saying that the performance specifically. He's not being called to say that the performance is deficient.
Right. But if he's being called to say, here's a different, reasonable way of handling the defense, and defense counsel did not do that, then isn't he saying that defense counsel's strategy was not reasonable?
Well, I don't think he went that far in this case, Your Honor. And normally the concern that this court would have with expert testimony is the fear of a runaway jury, that the expert would come in and persuade the jury that they should just do something unreasonable. And if I heard the government correctly, the Attorney General acknowledges Judge Boren's vast experience.
Yeah. So let me help you out on this. So Mr. Fink was not brought in as an academic question as to whether there were alternative ways of handling the defense, right? This is not just an academic question.
Right. He was brought in to talk about performance,
right,
about what an attorney should do, a reasonable attorney at the trial court level.
Yeah, because that's the question, that's part of the question that we answer in the first prong of Strickland.
You have to, of course, Strickland does require the court to make a finding that there was deficient performance.
Yes. And
right.
So tell me how Mr. Fink's testimony differs from the considerations that the court has to make under the first prong of Strickland.
Well, it differed because what Judge Boren wanted to hear in this case was what a attorney presented with this fact pattern ought to do. And I think that it's reasonable for trial courts to rely on that testimony if the judge finds that it could be useful. It's still susceptible to being challenged on relevance grounds. If the trial court judge doesn't want to hear it, he or she can exclude it. The trial court judge could certainly exclude it on Daubert grounds if there's some reason to believe that the experiential component wasn't satisfied. So there's already mechanisms to exclude that evidence.
Yes, but the question of oughtness is the first prong of Strickland.
Sure. And that wasn't the purpose of Attorney Fink's testimony, and I think when you read the transcript, what Attorney Fink did was provide the court with some guidance on what a base-level performance would be when a person is presented with a client with an eye patch who has suffered a brain injury. Mm-hmm. The attorney is offering guidance to the trial court. He's certainly not directing the judge to make a finding.
Which he doesn't have the power to do, but what I'm trying to figure out is, how is this not testimony on the ultimate question? If he's brought in to say, this is the baseline performance for a defense counsel, you brought it in to distinguish that from what defense counsel actually did, right?
Right. He was offering, he was asked questions about what trial counsel failed to do in this case, and he offered an opinion that these things ought to have been done. Now, I think it's clear.
Okay, wait. Stop right there. He gave testimony about what ought to have been done.
Right.
Yes. So you concede that.
Getting records, for example.
Okay.
Examining the brain injury. These are critical things in a case where a defense attorney at the trial court is defending somebody on this type of case. Those are crucial things that had to be done.
Right. So how is that different from the judge's determination of whether something was deficient?
Well, I think that the judge, obviously, as Your Honor noted, makes the ultimate conclusion. So it's different in the sense that many times we have experts in criminal cases, Your Honor, who come in and offer their opinions about a specific area of expertise, a specific field.
Yes, and this is a question of law.
That's what he did.
This is a question of law, right? This is a legal determination that the judge is to make whether or not defense counsel's performance was deficient. That's a question of law.
Yes, it is a question of law.
And so what you had was Mr. Fink coming in to give testimony about a question of law.
He's talking about the performance of the attorney. And then the judge has the legal responsibility of implementing that and making the determination of whether what the attorney did was reasonable. The judge isn't required to follow the testimony, Your Honor. And our position is that there ought to be a broad rule that allows trial court judges to consider all the evidence that they see as relevant in making their decisions. We think that better decisions are reached at the end of the day when a judge is allowed to consider a broad range of testimony. And we know from our discussions, just from hearing from other lawyers around the state, there's prosecutors that use this type of evidence. At Mockner hearings, there's prosecutors who call defense attorneys to offer the opinion that the performance in this specific case was adequate. And so it does happen. This isn't a unique phenomenon that just occurred in the PICO matter. It's something that trial court judges – I see my time is up, Justice.
Yes, it is.
Can
you
I finish?
You may make a brief concluding remark, and then you're finished.
Thank you. And so I appreciate the questions, Justice Kelly. I think that the conviction in this case should give all of us pause. I think that Jonathan Lavoie's performance was clearly fell below a basic level of care in this case. His failure to order records, his failure to investigate anything, and his essentially eyeballing the condition and reaching a conclusion that nothing should be done is not reasonable.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for a very interesting case, for excellent briefs, and very good argument. Thank you so much. We are going to adjourn the court will meet in closed conference according to my email before we begin. Thank you.